Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Religion and politics. Two topics you're not supposed to bring up at the dinner table. But reporters here at WOSU decided to tackle them in a new series called The State of Religion. From the religious right to Christian nationalism, abortion, prayer in schools, and how this all comes together in our state house, this series explores the intersection of faith and public policy. Chronicling religion's shift as Ohio moved from territory to state to the modern day. We're talking about the state of religion in Ohio this hour, and we begin with WOSU reporter Renee Fox and WOSU's All Things Considered host, Debbie Holmes. Renee, Debbie, welcome to All Sides.
Well, thank you so much, Anna, for having us here.
Yeah, hi, Anna.
Hi. Religion and politics, like I said, are two topics that are thought to be unfit for polite company. So what made you want to go out and ask people about them?
Well, I can say it was my idea to put this series together, so you can blame me. But, you know, I've been around a long time, and so we've heard religion talked about in politics during political campaigns and such, people bringing their faith forward to talk about different issues and how their faith is so important to them. But we wanted to look at what is that connection then with the legislature and lawmakers? And what does that mean for all of society then when certain laws are passed that are somewhat religious based? We can talk about abortion, which is one very, very much so,
very
I believe.
Strong intersection of religion and politics.
Right. We wanted to know, so how does all of this relate to religion and its use in society? Who are the players then behind this? Where can this go? Where can this all lead us? Because we've got so many battles going on with different religious groups and people that are not religious, that are agnostic or atheists.
Growing number of people who are not religious.
A growing number, exactly. That's what I found in my part. So we wanted to just kind of put this in a series, and you know, one person could not do all of this. So unless we were doing it like a week or a month at a time, but we thought we would just get everybody together and work on this.
Mm-hmm. So, Renee, this is a four-part series told by four different reporters. Mm-hmm. How did you all decide who was going to do what?
Well, that was fun because Debbie and I planned it. So we kind of took what we wanted to do. I do a lot of political reporting. And so I kind of took a step back from that for this project and went into more historical reporting, which I really enjoyed. It was fun for a different change of pace for myself. And I think Allie Vugrinzik, our great reporter, too, she got to try some things she wasn't always used to doing.
She did the statehouse stuff.
Yeah, which she doesn't always do.
Right.
And so it made for different results than we would normally get, and I think it was a fun exercise.
So two of the stories have aired, two have yet to air. Mm-hmm. But Renee, yours was the first in this series, mm-hmm. and it traces the history of religion in Ohio all the way back to the Native American tribes that once called this state home.
Right. And there's not a lot known about them because of how history unfolded, obviously, and what many historians have classified as a genocide. But before the Native Americans were forced out of Ohio, there was a prophecy that that one of their members had, Nealon, and it kind of foresaw this. It's kind of an interesting mixture of like Native spiritualism and Christianity, this prophecy that determined if they didn't put up a fight and hold on to the land, that it would be over. And
awesome. Yeah, and when you look at all of the mound works across Ohio, they were supposed to have religious significance. There were pilgrimages of Native Americans from all across America.
Right, and there's like a Flint Ridge really near those areas where people might have explored Flint. And sadly, with most of those relics, there's little known because those ancestors were gone even before settlers came to Ohio.
Yeah, the European settlers brought several different denominations of Christianity to Ohio, mm-hmm. including Mormonism and the Amish. You know, in Northeast Ohio, there's the Johnson Home, where LDS church members believe God gave Joseph Smith certain revelations. It's also one of the places he was tarred and feathered.
Run out of town.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to me that Ohio has been the center of all these different types of faith, because you don't see the Amish, you don't see the Mormons in like everywhere in the country.
Right. I think that's one of the things I learned the most about this project was just how many different types of religions there are in Ohio and how many denominations of Christianity you can find and still call it diverse. But yeah, and what was interesting, though, that I learned during the research of this project is a lot of Ohio settlers came just straight across geographically. So we've got a lot of the Pennsylvania Dutch is where we get a lot of the Amish population from in the northern part of Ohio. And in central Ohio, we got more of like the Congregationalist type and lots of different denominations of Protestantism.
And then down in Cincinnati, you have a concentration of Catholics. And you chronicle some of the clashes over prayer in school.
Yeah, there was a very interesting court case. Even before the United States as a whole decided public schools should not have prayer in it, Ohio did. But it wasn't an easy court case, of course. It was the later 1800s, and Cincinnati was kind of a big melting pot, just like the rest of the United States, but it was really concentrated there, lots of different religions. And up until this point, really, most of like the institutions had this like just stasis of Protestantism. It was kind of a presumed Christianity culture, and most people were presumed to be Protestant of some variation. And some Catholic and Jewish families were like, well, we don't want our kids singing the King James Bible hymns and learning from that version of the Bible or learning from that part of the Bible, and took it to court. And after, you know, going back and forth through several different cases or through different courts, the Ohio Supreme Court did rule in favor of the Catholic and Jewish families.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We've also made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court twice on different religious cases. Mm-hmm. One was Huffman v. Purdue, which was about pornography in public spaces. Ironically, it was argued by Senate President Matt Huffman's father.
Right, right.
And then the Obergefell case, which legalized gay marriage in the United States, started right here in Ohio, Debbie.
Right, that's correct. Yes, we remember that. That was 2015, I believe, when it was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right, about a decade after Ohio had made it illegal for gay marriage to happen.
Exactly.
The Right to Life movement also started in Cincinnati. So we have a surprisingly outsized role in some of what we call like modern day like religion and politics.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So part two, if I can, she explained part one. Part two is about the influence of various organizations in the legislature and in society. Some of those are faith-based that play a role. And reporter Matthew Rand covered that segment.
It was excellent, by the way. You guys should all
go listen to it. I listened to it twice this morning. Mm-hmm. And I had listened to it, of course, multiple times before. He had tried to talk with some groups that just said no. Moms for Liberty, ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which goes state by state to get the same legislation passed.
It's called legislation, but yeah.
Right. And the Alliance Defending Freedom, all of those did not send anybody or did not respond to a request for comment. So he spoke to a local minister as well as Aaron Baer with the Center for Christian Virtue, which is a very conservative organization.
We're
going to
hear from him later this hour. Yeah.
Well, I'm great.
Yeah.
We like to hear all sides of things.
On all sides.
Did either of you have trouble finding people who wanted to talk? Anybody turn you guys down?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. My focus was the fourth part, which is the changing religious landscape. So what the numbers look like in some ways, with evangelical Protestants gaining the most since 1980, now being about 20% of overall populations of those attend with the overall population in Ohio for those attending religious services. They were 8% in 1980. So that's quite a jump in four decades.
Yeah.
And you also have a growing agnostic and atheist group.
The nuns.
Or the nuns, right.
And we don't like that.
N-O-N-E-S.
Yes, N-O-N-E-S, not nuns right. Wearing habits. Yeah, we did a show a couple of weeks ago about the rise of the nuns.
Mm-hmm. They're about 40% now in Ohio, according to estimates by the U.S. Religion Census. So we have a changing religious landscape. I tried to speak to the Catholic Diocese of Columbus, and they declined a request for comment. And okay,
it happens.
You know, they're one of the congregations that are losing a lot of people. Yeah.
Right, they have lost, according to this census, about 7% from, I think it was 22% down to 15% now. So from 1980 to 2020, those are the decades.
Yeah, Debbie, you also spoke with one person, Ohio State sociology professor Corey Little Edwards, who described religion in the most interesting way, and we're going to play a clip of that.
Religion is an institution. It's an institution that is led by leaders and people who follow those leaders. It is an institution of networks of religious organizations and denominations. And so that still has a good deal of influence and power.
Debbie, I think it's such a fascinating concept, like religion as an institution, like a public institution.
Well, I mean, it is.
Yeah.
It's got its bureaucracy, I would guess. Mm-hmm. It's hierarchy, for sure.
It also helped people pass civil rights laws. Because,
right.
Yeah. I mean, people could gather together and work together in an institution.
Exactly. It's been influential in many, many ways in society, in many beneficial ways. We have many hospitals that are religion, that grew out of religious organizations.
The social gospel that encouraged that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's,
right.
You know, thrift stores and all kinds of charities that are religion-based.
Mm-hmm. And I spoke with Bishop Timothy Clark, who is the pastor, senior pastor at First Church of God. It's a predominantly Black church, and it's on the southeast side of Columbus. And he was saying about, yes, the history of the Black church has been its work in striving for social justice and such. It was all instituted because of racism and Black people not being allowed to worship with white people in churches. So they therefore had to create their own churches and their own institutions of worship.
Right. Yeah, I think what is really fascinating to me is just the breadth and the depth of the people that you talk to. You talked, you know, Ali Vergrinzik's piece, which will air tomorrow, has Jewish, Hindu, and Christian lawmakers at the State House. Like, you mm-hmm. talked to actual voters about how their religion influences them, faith leaders. It's just, I mean, there are so many voices. I, like, as somebody who now is, like, you know, a year into doing radio, I'm like, oh, that was a lot to put together.
It was, and, you know, when I first put mine together, it was, like, 3 minutes too long. I had to chop, chop, chop.
I know
chop.
That feeling.
Mine was about twice as long as it should have been.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, there was just so much to say, and we could say more and more and more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this could go on.
Yeah, we talked to people that didn't even make it into the series, but that informed our perspectives, too. Mm-hmm. That helped us shape our approach and whatnot. And we also found so many cool sounds of religion to bring into the project, of people worshiping, and just like the melodic sounds that you hear from bells or calls to prayer.
Right. Also the sounds of people protesting,
mm-hmm.
Those in the worship sector.
Yeah.
When they go to protest, we had those sounds, and they were all collected. There was a big American Religious Sounds project, and an Ohio State University professor, Isaac Weiner, was part of that. And he was like, yeah, you can use any sound you want.
Well, that's a big catalog, probably.
It was huge mm-hmm. catalog from many states. Columbus, also Ohio.
Michigan,
and elsewhere. I used some from Georgia, mm-hmm. out of a Baptist church. So, yes. And that just kind of, you know, gives you a little taste of everything that's going on in this country.
We also have a fun anti-pornography ad tidbit in mind.
So obviously these are airing on Morning Edition, but if people listening want to go hear the entire series, where can they find it?
They can go to wosu.org/Snollygoster. And
Snollygoster
right
is our politics podcast, for those who don't know. It's run by Mike Thompson, so you can find it there.
Find it there. You can also find it on our front page
in the
of our
podcast
website,
feed.
In our website.
So wosu.org.
That's right.
You can go to Snollygoster's, like, podcast feed on Apple, on Spotify, or wherever
correct.
You get it.
Yes.
And you can also tune in to Morning Edition, essentially.
That's right.
Yeah.
Tomorrow morning and Thursday morning at 6:50 and 8:50.
This is a question for both of you, and I guess, Renee, I'll start with you. What do you hope people take away from the series?
I think seeing the historical context of how our clashes and differences have morphed over time should, I think, hopefully let people take a step back in the present day and say maybe some of our really hard felt beliefs might evolve over time if we give them a chance, that that you might find allies with people that you didn't realize you had a lot in common with because you have a different style or perspective of religion.
I think maybe people stopping to think what is happening in their own lives with religion and such, and what are they hearing, what are they seeing, and how do they want to relate to other people that maybe not of their faith? How do they want to connect? Do they want to be confrontational all the time? Or is there a way to bridge gaps and to really find that, you know, we can live more cohesively?
And that we might need to find a replacement for religion if it keeps dwindling away. Like, what do we use to come together and find similarities with each other?
That was one of the questions. I mean, it's like an old book called Bowling Alone. And it's all about the decline of faith, because faith is that third place, that place where we get together and find community. And what do we do to do that if we don't have churches and temples and mosques for it as much?
Right. Yeah, that's a big question that nobody has an answer for. We talk to a lot of people.
We've got a lot of people being homeschooled, so they don't have the school congregations as much either.
Mm. That was Debbie Holmes, host of All Things Considered. Thank you for this time in the morning.
Thank you so much, Anna.
And thanks to WOSU reporter Renee Fox.
Thanks, Anna.
You can catch the State of Religion Project tomorrow morning on Morning Edition on Snollygoster or WOSU.org. Coming up, we're talking about the rise of Christian nationalism. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about the intersection of religion and politics this hour as part of WOSU's State of Religion series. Earlier, we spoke with the reporters who asked Ohioans about how their faith influences their votes. Now, we're asking about how religion shapes public policy. Here to help us with that conversation is Paul Jupe. He's a professor at Denison University and the author of The Full Armor of God, The Political Mobilization of Christian Nationalism in American Politics. Paul, welcome to All Sides.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with the basics. What is Christian nationalism? Because I think it pops up in the early 2000s, and I feel like before that, they were just called the religious right. Are they kind of the same thing?
They are kind of the same thing, although it's now much more a focus on a particular worldview as opposed to just Christians being conservative. We're now talking about trying to address, I think for them, a deep sense of loss, that they feel that their status has been challenged and they want to regain that. And so Christian nationalism, if we want to talk about a definition, is really about the conflation of faith with the nation. Stated simply in Lincolnian terms, we could say it's a desire for a nation of, by, and for Christians, which might give them elevated status or at least put them in control.
So it really seems to take root in American politics in the late 70s and early 80s, because as somebody who loves political history, you know, Carter won a significant number of white evangelicals, but then Reagan takes them in 1980. And really ever since then, white evangelicals are solidly Republican.
There's a long trajectory of trying to move the solid South, which was Democratic, of course, into the Republican camp, which in many ways they fit more cleanly because of their social conservatism. And so I think they felt betrayed. It's nice of you to bring up Carter. I think that evangelicals felt betrayed by Carter's liberalism, that he wasn't a champion for evangelical social positions. And so, yes, Reagan did inherit that, and of course said famously that he knew that they couldn't endorse him, but he would endorse them. And from then on, I mean, it's continued to grow, the association of Republicans and evangelical Christians.
Yeah, and they seem to coalesce around certain sort of issues like access to abortion, birth control, prayer in school, pornography, and now school choice. Is that kind of like, am I covering most of them there?
You hit them.
And I guess it's what's really interesting to me is that so Donald Trump wins more than 80% of white evangelicals in the last two presidential elections. I think it's like 81%. And Hillary Clinton, though, in 2016, won more than 90% of black Protestant Christians. They apparently don't classify black Americans as evangelicals. It seems to be a white term, which is something we could also discuss. But I just find that really interesting that when you look at like black faith leaders, they go Democratic. When you look at white faith leaders, they go Republican.
You know, that's true, although it's changing. And of course, the history goes back to the sort of very beginning of African Americans in the United States and how slave owners used religion as a way to try to control that population. Of course, they split off and have been have their own denominations, although there's quite a bit of cross attending. But yes, this today still African Americans, because of the civil rights stance of the Democratic Party, still tend to associate with Democrats. Although we can look at, say, the gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina, who's a black Republican, and he's very conservative. And so, actually, there's been a growth in African American evangelicals. They would take that term, even if we don't sort of use that as a classification, who have been moving toward the Republican Party.
Yeah, they tend to be conservative on social issues in particular. So you would think, oh, they should align with conservatism. But overall, when you look at the numbers, it seems to be that the more you go to church, the more likely you are to be Republican. And the less you go, the more likely you are to be Democrat. It's so strange because 40, 50 years ago, that was not the case.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, we can look not too long ago and find that over 90% of Democrats were religious, and most of those were Christian. And it started perhaps in the 1990s where they really start to diverge. It's still important to remember that about 2/3 of Democrats are religious, and still a majority of them are Christian. But obviously, the parties are really starting to diverge on the level of religiosity and the type of religion that they affiliate with.
I want to play a clip of Donald Trump speaking here in Ohio in the summer of 2020, and I'm going to apologize for the audio not being great. There is a plane in the background as he's speaking.
Take away your guns, destroy your Second Amendment, no religion, no anything, hurt the Bible, hurt God. He's against God, he's against guns, he's against energy, our kind of energy.
He's against God. He wants to hurt the Bible. These were claims leveled at Joe Biden. I mean, that is much more explicit than we've heard from presidential candidates in the past. It was, you know, from Reagan, you can't endorse me, but I can endorse you, to the Democrats want to destroy God.
I mean, maybe we could go back to the election of 1800 and find similar kinds of rhetoric.
Okay,
but, yeah.
I love the election of 1800 because Jefferson had like questions about the divinity of Christ. So yes, but I don't know that we're gonna get in that detour.
No, that's right. I just had to mention it. But I love that clip because I've quoted that and cited that multiple times in writings because it is such a strident kind of statement. And Biden has been religious his entire life, but this is the state of American politics now, and it's part of a Republican project where they rely on a voter base that's shrinking over time. And so if they want to continue to mobilize at the same level, sort of, you know, keep the coalition, keep the party going, they have to use more and more strident rhetoric. And so threat is the most potent mobilizer there is. And you can see, you know, if the Democrats are going to start persecuting Christians, if they're going to take away God and our right to believe and practice, that's a pretty good reason to go out and vote.
Yeah, and it, you know, about one third of Democrats say they go to church once a week. But I should note the country as a whole is getting less religious. But when it comes to Democrats in particular, sometimes I wonder, do you think they struggle to use moral or religious language? Like that, or they just choose not to in a way that Republicans do.
Right. I think they do use religious language. They do use sort of general values that would accord with religious faith. They're quite unlikely to use particularistic language, and that's mostly because their coalition is so diverse. I mean, it's, you know, it encompasses all the way from atheists to very devout religious figures, both in Christianity and in non-Christian faiths. And so they have to be more inclusive in the kind of language they hear. But it was natural for a Joe Biden. It's natural for a Kamala Harris, and certainly for Hillary Clinton to use that kind of language. And she did. But it's certainly not strident like Republicans have been using.
And it is interesting to me because progressive achievements like the civil rights movement in particular relied heavily on religious rhetoric. I mean, just look at Martin Luther King.
No, that's absolutely right. Even though they were grounded in a particular faith, and sometimes he would use Bible passages to illustrate those and give them added heft, they were also values that everybody could endorse, right? I mean, they're very inclusive notions. So it certainly stands in, you know, total contradistinction to the sort of Christian nationalist rhetoric that's being thrown around today.
Yeah, you know, when it came to the movement for the legalization of gay marriage, one of the things, like, initially they started off with the idea of, like, equity, right? That we deserve the same rights as everybody else. And then it was interesting to me to watch that they shifted to this idea of love is love. This very inclusive, sort of almost more moral judgment on it. And that's really, to me personally, and maybe I'm reading too much into the rhetoric shift, that's when it seems like it really took off.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also think it's in many ways more individualistic. Like everybody can identify with love, right? And everybody makes different decisions about that, as opposed to thinking about equity, which is a comparison between groups. And so that might be a little bit more divisive than just saying, hey, let everybody be, you know, the individuals that they are.
Yeah, I do think some of the reason that Bernie Sanders is so popular with a certain segment of the progressive left is because he does use moral-sounding language when he talks about economic policies.
He really does. Although it's a strain to think about the religious connections of Bernie Sanders, but I think that's true. I mean, you know, politicians are constantly on the lookout for values that would transcend groups and bring them together. And you see that, I think, Harris and Waltz campaign right now, less so on the other side, which is, again, like really looking to mobilize a particular segment at extraordinarily high levels. So they're almost playing an entirely different game.
I will say, though, I want to play a cut from Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. He's a Republican, and he has this idea that Republicans worship God and Democrats, he says, they worship something else.
Here is the real truth. The left wants to replace God with an idol of their own making. They want to take God out of our history. They want to take the Bible out of our traditions. They want to tell us that anything that has to do with faith has got to be erased from the public square, and they want to replace it with their new state religion of wokeism. That's what they want. That's the struggle that we are facing. It's a whole new religion of woke that they want to place on us. They want to force on us.
I mean, Senator Hawley, that's pretty explicit that, I mean, we worship God and they worship an idol.
That's right. And, you know, we hear even more explicit kind of language that reinforces this notion. It's common these days to hear Christian nationalist figures talking about Democrats as ruled by demons, that there are demonic portals over the White House. I mean, so this language really says almost whatever we disagree with is motivated by essentially the devil's work here in the United States. And so, like, that's where wokeism comes in, which, you know, could have religious roots, of course, of inclusion. But they disagree with it. They think it's a threat. And so therefore they think that it's essentially evil, and we can't associate it with them.
Yeah, I think back to the 2008 campaign when John McCain, he was at some sort of rally and somebody made a very disparaging comment about Barack Obama. And he said, no, Obama is a good guy. We just disagree on fundamental issues. And I feel like that idea that we're all trying to do what we think is best, we just fundamentally disagree with how to do that best thing for the country, has been replaced with this battle for good and evil, where compromise and bipartisanship is like, you don't compromise with the devil.
Right, absolutely. And it's reinforced by a gradual sorting of the population. So, more and more Christians are Republicans, and rural people are Republicans, and city dwellers are Democrats. And so once you sort all these identities and groups into the two parties, then an election loss really starts to feel totalizing, like it's a loss of really anything, and your power is going to be lost essentially forever. And that's essentially what Republicans have been saying for a long time, is that if we lose this one, we're never going to get back in power.
Do you ever worry that the merging of faith and political identity is what's feeding this polarization?
Yes and no. There's plenty of cases throughout history where, you know, the confluence of faith and politics has really brought people together and has achieved great things and considerable change that works to the benefit of all. And then, you know, we're seeing, you know, obviously now where that conflation is really damaging. And I think it depends on just how it's organized, right? And so right now, because Republicans have targeted Christians and we need to mobilize them at very high levels, that the rhetoric necessary to do that is so negative and so divisive that that's the problem. So in and of itself, I don't think that religion and politics is problematic, but, you know, given the ends that politicians and political parties can put it, that's where we face some of the struggles.
How do we step back from all this? As somebody who studies the rise of Christian nationalism and this increasing good versus evil battle in our politics, how do we walk this back?
Yeah, so it's a really difficult question. And we've been trying to figure that out and trying to study it. And at least right now, we're so deep in it that it's hard for people to see past those barriers and possibilities for working together. So when we think about how this starts to change in the future, I think, you know, given the role of the political parties here in polarizing parts of society, I think we're just going to have to see some election losses where, you know, offering the promise of theocracy is just not beneficial. It's not a way to build a majority. And once that's true, once there's, you know, enough diversity in the United States across religion and across race and across lots of things, that's going to mandate that the parties change their approach. And I think that's where we finally see a dialed down level of the rhetoric.
What's that? You know, at the same time that we have this increasing religiosity in our politics or in the way we talk about our politics, fewer and fewer people are going to church, to temple, to the mosque. Like, more and more people are identifying as nuns, N-O-N-E-S. So not nuns with the habits. But it's interesting to me that we're getting more secular as a country at the same time that our politics seems to get more religious.
That's right. And this was an explicit way of talking to Christians about, you know, what's coming, about the threat that's coming, is that fewer and fewer people are believers. Therefore, our fundamental values are going to be threatened. And so I think it's really that sort of contest of power that's been portrayed to people that makes them think like, oh, yeah, no, this is really, really a problem. One of the interesting things, though, about the nuns is, you know, we kind of stereotype them as liberals, right? I mean, they left the church because they disagreed with conservative politics and this sort of thing, except that the more that the nuns grow, the less democratic they are. And that's a really kind of crazy little finding. But it's because they're coming from a much more diverse population. So there are fewer and fewer Democrats that are sort of left, you know, to be put off by conservative religion. So some of them that are coming out are actually more moderate, even Republican.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, you sort of look at Europe, which is far more secular than us. And I sort of wonder, are we headed in that direction?
I would think the answer is probably yes. And one of the things that's different, of course, is that there's no state church in the United States, at least for now. And that allows for a great diversity. I mean, Ohio's a great example, right? It's so pluralist. There's no dominant group out there. And that's really shaped the politics of Ohio. But, you know, across time, I think they're going to continue to fade, although I don't think we'll probably get to the levels of France anytime soon.
My final question for you is, you know, for those who hear the way we talk about politics and faith, and it really just turns them off for both, what would you want to say to somebody who's like, I can't stand any of this?
Well, you know, for good or for bad, I think they have to engage at this point. They need to see what's going on. They need to hear what's going on. And so it's great that, I mean, it's really fantastic that you're doing this series and you know, perhaps having me on. So, yeah, the more that we understand what the nature of the debates and how people are approaching their politics, the better off they are and the more they're going to be able to understand current American politics and engage with it sensibly.
That was Paul Jupe, a professor at Denison University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we're zeroing in on Ohio and how religion impacts laws created at our statehouse. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're spending this hour talking about religion and politics and the intersection of the two. Aaron Baer is the president of the Center for Christian Virtue, one of the major groups that advocates down at our Ohio State House. Aaron, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be back, Anna.
So your website says that CCV, the Center for Christian Virtue, advocates for, quote, public policy that reflects the truth of the gospel. Can you walk us through what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we believe God's word is true for everybody, whether they believe it or not, and has great insights for what makes people flourish, what makes people thrive. And so we come down with a perspective that says, hey, you know what? Every individual has human dignity. Everybody is deserving of religious liberty. Families matter. Keeping government off our backs matters. And so that's the perspective we bring to the debate at the Ohio State House.
Would you consider yourself a Christian nationalist or no?
That's not a word I would use to describe myself. If people want to use that to describe us, they're going to say what they say. Most of the time when folks use that term, they try to use it to silence or stigmatize.
It's usually a pejorative, yeah.
Exactly. So that's not a term we go around and thump our chest with, but at the end of the day, if folks don't want to engage with us on the ideas, then call us whatever they want.
So I want to ask, how do you reconcile the separation of church and state with your beliefs, with advocating for public policy that reflects the gospel? How do you put those two things together when you're down at the state house talking to lawmakers?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, that's a fairly easy one. First and foremost, the separation of church and state talks about keeping the government out of the church's business. But at the end of the day, we have to have an honest conversation that every law we pass is based on a moral statement, right? We have laws against killing. We have laws against stealing. We have laws that say you can't go over 35 miles an hour in certain areas. And all of those are based on a moral judgment of saying, hey, we should protect other life. It's dangerous if people go too fast here. And so the question is, what are we basing those moral claims on? We're basing them on the fact that we think the Bible is true. And that this has good insight for how we should structure and order our lives, both individually and corporately.
Yeah, even when it comes down to something like the budget, I've always said that if you show me where you spend your money, I'll show you what you believe. And that's absolutely true for state budgets.
Exactly. And that's one of these things that You know, I agree in concept with the idea that you can't legislate morality, right? You can't necessarily make people become more moral just through laws alone. Certainly the law is a moral teacher. We can see that good laws help people make good decisions. But none of this is about trying to force people into a faith or anything like that. It's about trying to structure society, order our culture, order our state in a way that allows the most people to thrive.
We'll talk about, you know, you've advocated for laws restricting abortion access and banning trans youth from accessing puberty blockers and hormones. And we'll talk about those in a minute. But I wonder, how does your faith influence your stance on immigration? Because a lot of times people coming to this country, say from Venezuela or Haiti, or particularly the Chinese, who say they're escaping religious persecution in their country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, this is a prudential conversation we're having here, right? Of should we allow folks to come in who are refugees or people who are being harmed? Absolutely, we should. But we also should do that in a manner that is measured, that we can accommodate, that we can handle. Again, I think the whole Springfield conversation is a great example of this, where everything's getting bogged down in conversations about cats and dogs. But you talk to people there, and you'll talk to moms that say, I'm afraid to let my 17-year-old drive in the street because there's people driving around that don't have driver's license, that don't understand our laws, and their social systems have been overwhelmed, right? This is an example of bad immigration policy. So should we allow folks to come in from other countries, even third world countries? Absolutely. But we need to do it in a measured way that also is caring for the people, our existing citizens that we have today.
Or perhaps, I guess, invest the money that may be needed to help the social services, to help the job training, the driver's ed, to like make sure that if we're going to bring all those people in, that we're actually going to support them once they get here.
Support them and the people that are already there. Again, I think there's a very measured conversation here. I used to work in Arizona. I worked in the Arizona Attorney General office. Went down to the border multiple times and saw what happened under the Obama-Biden more open border policies. And that wasn't loving both to the people, especially living on the border, but even for the people that were being, that we were inviting traffickers and other folks to bring them across the border illegally. So again, this is a very prudential conversation that we should be having. And a lot of times it gets bogged down in just name calling.
Yeah, because when you look at some of the largest refugee resettlement institutions here in the United States, like the Catholic Church is one of the largest resettlers of refugees.
Oh, absolutely. And again, even you look at the folks who are doing the most for pregnant mothers, right, who need help. You know, the pregnancy centers, there's over 100 pregnancy centers all over Ohio that provide services that no abortion clinic ever would, to help provide, you know, all of the things you need to be a mom, diapers and job services and baby cradles and all of these types of things. They're doing amazing work to help moms. And that's what the Christian belief and faith is all about.
I do want to talk about abortion. It's sort of the elephant in the room because it's the most obvious place where your faith can very strongly dictate how you feel about this topic. It's obviously you were opposed to issue one last November. I'm getting really tired of saying issue one at this point. Like, I'm really glad that the legislature has changed how we're going to number these. But the reproductive rights
that was issue 1B. Yeah, we're now on issue 1C, I think. So, yeah, anyway.
But, you know, obviously safe to say you were disappointed with how that vote came out. But, you know, how do you square the idea that perhaps, you know, Ohioans as a whole, whether they love the Reproductive Rights Amendment but want some access or believe people should have some access to abortion? Like, where do groups like yours go from there?
Yeah, I think the reality is we have to accept that Ohio overwhelmingly voted this way. I don't think that the extreme nature of this abortion amendment is where they want. I think as we're starting to see these lawsuits being filed against aspects of abortion laws we had that they probably weren't really thinking of when they went to go vote, things like the 24-hour waiting period, informed consent, regulations on the abortion pill. I think we're going to see voters maybe have some buyer's remorse on it. But certainly for CCV, we've been saying since then, we have a lot of work to do to convince people, first and foremost, of the dignity of an unborn child, but also, too, of the dangers of later-term abortion. And so, again, that's a lot of what we do is you know, I've not made a political donation to a candidate in Ohio in my life. Everything we do is we do convince it. We go off and talk in churches and talk in communities and talk with folks like you and say, hey, here's why we believe what we believe.
Where do you come down on the stuff then, like paid family leave or expansion of Medicaid services or things that might help, say, or increasing eligibility for subsidized childcare, things that might make it easier for someone to become a parent?
You know, honestly, I look at these issues very similarly to how I look at immigration, where it's a very prudential conversation of how do we get to the place where the most people can thrive, right? And I think we've seen that the expansion of the welfare state, as we've done it in America, hasn't allowed for the most people to thrive, right? We've put out the most, a lot of services, but you're still seeing a lot of people struggle. And so we have to look at what is that balance of having a good social safety net, but also making sure that we're incentivizing work. Again, this is where our Christian faith really comes into play here, is that we believe there's dignity in work. We believe we were made to work. That's what we read that even in Genesis, that we were people that were made to work. And so we want to encourage that as much as possible and encourage that self-sustainability. For some folks, that's not possible for a wide array of reasons. And we want to have a social safety net. But we'd probably say, we would say today, it's grown to such a side that's actually disincentivizing work, which is dehumanizing to a lot of people.
So you have a section on CCVU's website entitled What Churches Can Do. So I want to ask you about this. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion on the limitations of the Johnson Amendment? And real quick, for those who don't know, the Johnson Amendment is a provision in the tax code that says nonprofit organizations, like churches, can't endorse or oppose political candidates. So what can they do? What can they not do?
Yeah, so right now under IRS code and with the interpretation of the Johnson Amendment as it is churches can endorse or oppose ballot initiatives, and I should say all 501c3s, right?
Right.
So even left or right-leaning, right, can endorse or oppose ballot initiatives. Pastors can speak out or oppose ballot initiatives from the stage and support or oppose legislation, right? But they can't endorse or oppose candidates, right? That's why we put out a 501c3 voter guide that just sort of reports on where the candidates stay. We would say we actually would like to see the Johnson Amendment abolished. I think actually the best running sort of First Amendment jurisprudence on it would say the Johnson Amendment is unconstitutional, but it's just being able to get into the court to say, hey, you can't tell pastors from the pulpit what they can and cannot say. Actually, if you look historically, I think only one time in the early 90s did the church actually lose their tax status due to the Johnson Amendment. I would argue a lot of churches, especially churches on the left, do a lot of endorsing of candidates that don't actually get caught up. Just generally speaking, we think pastors should be free to say whatever they want from the pulpit.
So the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate begin their sessions with a prayer. So anybody who's never actually gone to session at the legislature, they start with a prayer and a Pledge of Allegiance. And I want to play an excerpt from reporter Ali Vugrinzik's piece in the State of Religion series, where she looks at lawmakers and their approach to public policy.
Within minutes of walking onto the House floor, freshman legislator Danny Isaacson encountered something unexpected, a proposed rule to require Christian prayer before sessions.
That sent a message to those of us who are not Christian that the legislature was not open to us.
So Danny Isaacson is talking about this rule proposal that actually never got voted on. I mean, the opening of session was kind of chaotic. And it was this idea that if you were going to, you had to have a Christian prayer. You could have a Muslim prayer, you could have a Hindu prayer, but you'd also have to have a Christian one. And I mean, what do you make of the idea that like a Jewish lawmaker sitting there was like, oh, that's uncomfortable?
Yeah, again, in the big scheme of things, this feels like, you know, a minor issue in terms of folks getting caught up in the day-to-day. I'll just say, you know, at the end of the day, we want to allow everyone to pray. CCV wasn't a part of that rule in particular. But even a Christian prayer is not necessarily attacking any other faith. Of all the issues actually facing the state, that's not the thing we're most concerned about. We think it's important that we open in prayer. And we think it's important, you know, I'd argue it's good that you do a Christian prayer, because we would say that's a true prayer to the true God, who we want his blessing on the state. And on our lawmakers as they make very important decisions. So we don't hide from that. We think we need to continue to have prayer in these public settings, because it helps orient us in the right direction.
I will say that Representative Isaacson says later in the interview that they've held two Passover Seders at the State House and that they've had bipartisan lawmakers from all different faiths and cultures attend. So there is definitely work being done there.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is, a lot of times folks will criticize us, as you said, you know, folks will call us Christian nationalists. And we're saying, hey, we're just participating in the system that we have the freedom to participate in. Anybody else is able to go do the same thing too. And it makes the system stronger when we do.
Final question for you. Do you ever worry that politics as it is just getting too vitriolic right now, too good and evil focused?
Yes and no, right? I, by all means, I do worry about the civility. You know, I saw a Cincinnati Inquirer story, a letter to the editor, I should say, that they published today that talked about President Trump had it coming for the second assassination attempt. That feels really dangerous. At the other time, when CCV, we see things that we never could have thought we'd imagined, sterilizing gender clinics all over the state. We need to call those things out and oppose them. We see literacy rates at abysmal rates, especially in the city of Columbus. And so we need to call that out and do better. So some of these things, it's just the nature of where we are today.
That was Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue. Thank you for your time this morning. And thank you all for listening to WOSU here on 89.7 NPR News.